Cambridge 105 Radio.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women.
We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results. I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe, and we produce and present Women Making Waves.
In this edition of Women Making Waves, we meet Louise Tennakoon, who has over 20 years' experience of working in sustainability. Louise is a life coach and is making waves, trying to combine her family life and her life passion to support the climate change movement.
And we meet Petra Hayton and Sophie Whedon, who are neighbours who have started their own business selling pre-loved clothes and accessories. The women are from different generations and they tell us how the age gap is a positive thing.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Before becoming a life coach, Louise Tennakoon spent over 18 years as an entrepreneur and consultant, working on sustainability and ethical trade. Passionate about making a difference in the world, Louise talks to Susie about the challenges she faces both from a personal and ethical point of view.
And that was the first time I came across a guy. He was a professor at the School of Management, but also at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And he was the first person I'd ever heard say, there's no reason why we can't have a strong economy and a clean environment. And that message really hit home with me.
My guest today is Louise Tennakoon. Louise has over 20 years' experience of working in sustainability that involved travelling to different parts of the world, investigating global supply chains for well-known large retailers, now looking at environmental impacts of their products and the impact on people, and is now a life coach, a mum, a wife, a columnist, and I'd like to say, an eco-warrior. Hello, Louise.
Hello, Susie.
Why you started off in sustainability? What prompted you?
Oh, my goodness. I have to go back a long way. So I was doing my master's in international relations in the States. And the school that I was at, you had the opportunity to draw on courses from all the different graduate and professional schools. And we had the opportunity at the beginning of term to go shopping, and we literally went and sat in on each of the classes, and the professors would try to convince us that their class was the one to take. And that was the first time I came across a guy. He was a professor at the School of Management, but also at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And he was the first person I'd ever heard say, there's no reason why we can't have a strong economy and a clean environment. And that message really hit home with me. So
how old were you then, did you
gosh,
say?
Gosh, I was 20.
Okay, so that's quite an impressionable age, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you hadn't heard that before?
I really hadn't heard that message before. Mm. To be honest, I mean, that was 30 years ago. Sustainability wasn't really a mainstream issue at that time. You know, people were beginning to talk about it, but it wasn't a really big thing.
So you heard this from your professor. Mm. And how did you move forward with that?
I designed my course around sustainability. It became a course in environmental policy and management. And while I was there, I put together an international conference and I drew speakers from across the world to talk about how we could improve the environment and get competitive advantage at the same time. So it was trying to put a real business edge on it. And through that, I met a number of people in the UK who linked me into people when I got back. And that was how I got my first job as an environmental consultant.
And you started working, as I said, with quite big retailers.
I was actually taken on to work with B&Q, the DIY stores. And I worked pretty much exclusively with B&Q for quite a few years. And they had a very passionate, rather young, maverick sustainability champion at the time. And he and I worked together. And we were looking at global supply chains. We were looking at supply chains purely from an environmental point of view. And one day we got on a plane and we went to India to look at the impacts there. And we walked into a shed where people were polishing doorknobs, brass doorknobs, and they had scarves around their necks to keep the dust out of their mouths. And when we looked a little bit closer into that, we discovered that the TB rate amongst brassware polishers in that part of India was significantly higher than the rest of the population. And the message we took from that was people are dying to make the products. Mm. And clearly that just rang massive alarm bells, obviously.
And I must remind ourselves here, the year was when you were doing this sustainability work for B&Q. Did you say we're talking about 25 years ago?
Yeah, that would have been 92, 93, around that time.
What sort of prompted B&Q to do that? What was their message? What were they trying to get across? And was it just an internal thing, or was it a message they want to get out to their customers?
It was really the beginning of a sea change in that company, I would say. They were among the absolute pioneers. There was one guy on the board who took a gamble on this young sustainability guy who is now head of sustainability for ArcelorMittal, which is a vast steel company and has been a real leading light in the sustainability field. So it was really one man's gamble, I would say, but the company got behind it, and it was both internal and public facing.
Mm. And do you think then that was quite a sort of a unique moment for big retailers, or do you think there were a lot of retailers, companies doing that? Because I don't think that was in the mainstream. It was in the public knowledge, was it, at that time?
No, it wasn't. There was quite a bit of media coverage at that time. You know, every so often retailers were getting their fingers burnt with big stories in the media, whether that was about child labour or about low wages or about poor health and safety or fires in factories and people dying. So it was beginning to gather momentum as a sort of story, but no, there wasn't the kind of awareness that there is now.
And did you see them, the retailers and the big companies, did you see them act on your findings?
Well, to begin with, we were quite a maverick sort of company. But the companies that we attracted at that time were companies that really wanted to make a difference. And so, yes, there was quite a lot of action. There was quite a lot of... We were sort of helping them do sort of pilot projects. Well, actually, if you want to pay people more, how can you make that work? Is there a way to make things a bit more productive? Is there a way to sort of generate more money so that you can then afford to pay them a bit more? That sort of thing. Or how do you train people in health and safety? How do you help people become aware of the risks so that they can begin to take responsibility for their own health and safety?
And so from there, you spent... How many years did you spend doing your sustainable coaching then?
Gosh, so I was doing... after a few years in 97... I set up my own consultancy with a couple of friends, business partners.
Why did you do that?
Because I think we wanted to widen our net away from just, you know, I'd just been working with B&Q up to that point, essentially, and other companies were getting interested in the same kind of work. It was becoming not mainstream, but it was very much on people's agendas. And so we just saw an opportunity to reach a wider audience, I think. So yes, there was some action. I mean, I did that for about 7 years. And one of the reasons why I left was that I felt it had become too much of a tick box exercise. Within those 7 years, it shifted to the mainstream. It became something that every company had to do. And we were instrumental in setting up some of the structures to enable companies to do that. But it just became all about, oh, let's do an audit, let's report, rather than, what are we really going to do to make a difference? That was my feeling anyway. Mm. That was 7 years within that consultancy, which was my own company. But no, I left that essentially for personal reasons, which was that I got to the age of about 34 and I'd been completely... My life had been taken over by work, essentially. And I got to that age and I thought, if I don't do something about this soon, if something doesn't change, then I'm going to wake up and it's going to be 10 years down the line and I'm not going to have a family.
Yeah. But in the back of your mind, you've always been an environmentalist, an eco-warrior. You've always been thinking that things need to change. Mm. But maybe frustratingly, maybe that you were having a family and you couldn't do both?
It's always been about, I suppose, my motivation has always been about changing the world. Whenever people ask me what I want to do, that's always been my
answer.
Have
you always been like that?
But certainly since I started working, it's just always been there. Yeah. I can't see the point of doing anything else, really. It's been hard because I did sort of put everything on hold for sort of 6 or 7 years. And that was deeply frustrating at times. But I recognised that I wasn't able to juggle both, particularly doing my own thing. I think it does take a lot of energy and a lot of focus to make your own thing happen, whatever your own thing is. And I think that I just didn't have enough energy and focus to do that and to parent the way that I wanted to parent.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point about having families and concentrating on one thing, knowing that you have an allegiance to something else that you're very, very passionate about, which is children, family and climate change and making the world a better place. Now, with your knowledge that you have or you started to have before you had children, now you've got children, how hard is it to share your experience, to share that knowledge that you have with friends, family, children? Do you find that you have to take it little steps at a time? Because you do have a huge amount of experience behind you. And then suddenly, climate change is in the fore again.
I think climate change is particularly tricky to talk about because it is massively emotive. And the temptation is to be an ostrich. And to be quite honest, I was an ostrich when I first had the children. I literally stuck my fingers in my ears and I didn't want to know because I felt that I couldn't handle the truth of what was happening to the world when I had two tiny babies who I'd chosen to bring into that world. And I really found that enormously difficult. So I chose not to do it. And I think it's an entirely understandable response. But I've now got to the point where I've taken my fingers out of my ears. I've had a long, hard, cold look, or a hot look, probably, I should say, and realised that, yes, it's pretty bad. So I'm trying to find ways to draw people into conversations about climate change, which is why I'm beginning to take my coaching in that direction. And I think the overlap or the opportunity for coaching in climate change. At first, I didn't get it. I thought, well, how can you coach people around climate change? But I think the whole point of coaching, what it does beautifully, is it enables people to move from a place of fear and paralysis and I can't do it into a place of action. And that's where we all need to go around climate change. We need to get beyond the fear. We can accept it. It's there. It's not going to go away. But it's how can we accept that, live with that, be with that, but still move into action.
The art of protesting, is that your way of actually...
Yeah, it is. Oh, no, that's a really, really interesting question because I don't know the answer to that yet. And I have actually...
You think you might do some protesting?
Well, I think protesting is really important. I think it's a really significant piece of the jigsaw. We're not going to see the change we need, the scale, the speed, until it's enough of a problem that it's the first thing Boris Johnson thinks about when he wakes up in the morning. And let's face it, he's got a lot of other things to think about.
Well, he has. You're absolutely right.
So the only way we're going to get it where it needs to be on the agenda is for it to be a thorn in everybody's side, I'm afraid. And I do think that non-violent civil disobedience is probably the only way that that's going to happen. So I am going next week. I've just committed to go to the Extinction Rebellion October uprising next week. And I must be honest, I was a little bit hesitant because I was a little bit like, this is a really important piece of the jigsaw, but is it my piece? Exactly your question. Mm. And I still don't know. But I figure I owe it to myself and to my children and to the world to find out.
Why are you hesitant about it? What makes it so... I mean, actually, we're hesitant on most things about protesting. And once we see people marching, I suddenly feel very guilty about not going. So we're all hesitant. But why particularly you? Because you have so much knowledge about what we could do that...
I've been asking myself that question just this morning, Susie. I've been wandering in the house going, why am I so hesitant? There's a bit... I think it's to do with how people within Extinction Rebellion are perceived. Extinction Rebellion is ordinary people who care passionately and cannot see another way to make people wake up. They will sit down in the middle of a bridge and politely, non-violently disrupt things. Because, I mean, it's very easy to get frustrated with that kind of disruption. But climate change is going to disrupt our lives in so many more ways than people sitting in the middle of a bridge in London, you know? But most people, I think, aren't there yet.
Yeah. Do you think that women are there yet as opposed to men? Do you think that, have you found that some of your, are your friends who are of the same, on the same page as you, are they both men and women? Or do you think, because the findings are recently that women are taking on board this issue much more than men. They have, sadly, they're more at home with the children than the men are. And so they worry about the future. And they worry about the future because it's living through the eyes of their children. So from your point of view, have you seen a bit of both? Maybe it's not a gender issue in your patch or in your area.
I think it probably is a gender issue, if I'm honest. I don't want it to be. And that's not to say that men don't care about it. Maybe they have more to distract them because, let's face it, it's we all quite welcome a bit of distraction from this particular story, I think. But, you know, interesting, speaks to your point. I've just joined a coaching circle created by a wonderful coach called Charlie Cox, based in Oxford, who is a climate change coach. And she has put together, we're part of the first climate change coaching circle. She's got 9 people together and we're all women.
Quite recently, you are a columnist.
Yes.
And you're reaching out to people in their own homes who buy their papers, and you are trying to not teach us, but you're alerting us to what we can do at home to make a difference, and actually just trying to change the culture of waste. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
How have you felt after doing that? You've had some response from people?
The response has been overwhelmingly positive, which has been lovely because I really didn't know what to expect. I mean, literally, when I first began, I would have people stopping me in the street every day saying, oh, thank you. This is really helping. We're finding it interesting and useful. So it was born out of a desire to help people make small decisions about how they could reduce their own impact at home. But I'm also trying to tie in global issues so that people can understand them a little bit better, make them understandable, digestible, and also link them into what's actually happening. Like, for example, this week I'm writing about water. I had a letter from the water company last week saying that we were in a drought and that we need to reduce our water consumption, otherwise we'll have a hosepipe ban by next spring. But it's like, well, actually, how does this connect to climate change, and how does this connect to what's the long-term prognosis for water in this area? And the answer is it's not good, really not good. So it's kind of tying that in and saying, and here's the part that you can play, here's your piece of the jigsaw. Because I think I've spent many years struggling to find my piece of the jigsaw, and it is so frustrating when you want to make a difference, you've got something to offer, but you just can't see where it fits. And I think a lot of people are beginning to feel that way.
Do you find that when you have dinner with your friends, or if you're with your friends and children, can you actually talk about it? It's a fine line, isn't there, between playing and talking with your children and your friends' children, your friends. How do you get that in the conversation without sounding militant?
Well, the column is one way to do it, because people invariably comment or say, oh, I read your piece, or, you know, so they in a way give me the in. I'm finding that people are much more receptive than they were. Funnily enough, we were at a party at the weekend and I started having a conversation about climate change, and then I heard the men, interestingly, having their own conversation about climate change at the other end of the table. And I kind of thought, well, this is interesting, because a year ago, we probably wouldn't have been having either of these conversations.
So from all that, do you find now that you are, I suppose, because you write a column for a newspaper, because you have experience, do you find then that the column has given you some liberating moments? Do you find that it's giving you that sort of platform to allow you to show what you believe in?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And particularly locally, it's given me an opportunity to, or a platform to, raise some issues that I think make me and a lot of other people angry in the community. Things around planning and around the ways that, you know, new developments are not as ambitious in sustainability terms as they should be, as they could be, and that no one's really picking that up and holding people to task. So I do quite enjoy that bit. I think there's something really important, isn't there, about holding people to account?
Yes.
Because it's not about blame or shame or trying to make anybody bad or wrong. It's just that we haven't got time to waste. We have to move this forwards. And so we have to hold people to account.
What about challenges in your life when it comes to sustainability and working with your family and your children and your extended family and friends? Have you literally gone into your lobby? Have you gone into a cupboard, which is what I do sometimes when I'm really frustrated, and scream your head off because you want people to understand, but sometimes you have to listen to their side of it, don't you?
Yeah. And I think it's hardest to do that with the people that you're closest to, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's because we obviously are emotionally invested in the agenda. We're emotionally invested in the people that we're talking to when they're people that we're very close to. And within families, there already are flashpoints, aren't there? We all have our annoyances and our buttons that our closest family know exactly how to press. And this just sort of amplifies all of that. An issue like climate change, or Brexit for another one, you know, that's another flashpoint for many families. And it doesn't mean we don't love each other. It just means that when we see things differently, it really matters. It feels like it really matters. Actually, it probably doesn't. But yeah. It feels like it does. And I think that's why it becomes very difficult. to talk about these things.
And Louise, what about social media? Do you find that's been good for the cause, or do you think it's inhibited it, or do you find that you stay away from it because it's just too much that you can't handle it all? Because some people are really good at it and they love it, they thrive on it. How does that work for you? I mean, you want to get your message across.
I have a bit of a tricky relationship with social media, I think it's fair to say. In some ways, I think it's great because it really gets, you can get a message out, you can mobilise people, you can connect with people you would never otherwise connect with, and you can start a dialogue and discussion. I really notice that it makes the newspaper column much more live. When the column goes online, suddenly you get comments and it becomes a live debate rather than just a flat article which people are reading on their own. So from that point of view, I think it has great potential. Personally, I can go down a complete rabbit hole with social media, particularly around climate change. You know, it can just really drag me down. And so I don't engage with it too much.
Mm. And what about education and children, your children and your friends' children? Do you think there is a lot more can be done in schools? Mm,
definitely. I don't know an awful lot about it because my children are still quite young and I'm not really aware of how climate change in particular is being handled in the national curriculum. This is a topic that's very close to my heart. How much do we tell our children about what is really happening in the world? And I'm still working that through. Make it relatable for them. So use stories, use images, use animals in particular, because they can really relate to animals. That we have a duty to tell them, because to keep it from them would be wrong. But at the same time, we can only give them what they can stomach and cope with. And I think it's got to be bit by bit by bit. Yeah. So for example, I've thought about, would I take my daughter who's 8 on a protest? And the conclusion I've reached at the moment is I won't until she asks to come. And when she asks to come, because it's her thing, then I'll take her gladly. Yeah. But at the moment, it's just too soon. They're going to have to live with this for the rest of their lives. They don't need to start worrying about it at 8.
And in your day-to-day life, now that you have this, well, you have an amazing cause and you're doing really, really well, and you're certainly telling a lot of people, a lot of readers, and how to change the way we use things, how not to waste things. But are there mistakes that you make that sometimes you don't want to tell people?
Oh, constantly.
Yeah. I'm glad you're human.
Constantly. Yes, big mistakes. I took on a zero waste challenge recently and I realised that is incredibly difficult. Yeah. And there's no way I'm ever going to be zero waste. No way. Oh, goodness me. The biggest issue for me, which isn't exactly a mistake because it is very intentional, the big issue for me and my family is flying. Because there is an argument that all you really need to do, or the two most significant actions you can make, is not eat meat and not fly. We don't eat meat, so we can tick that box, but flying is much more difficult because we come from a generation. I think we think we were brought up to believe it was our birthright to travel the world because it was relatively cheap, it was easy, it was available, and the world was open to us, and we all loved it. And to walk away from that, I mean, also my husband is from Sri Lanka, so we have family there. So to just say, well, we're never going to fly again, isn't going to wash yet. But that sits quite, I have a big tension around that. Mm. Sits quite uncomfortably with me.
And future-wise?
I think the future is probably around developing coaching for individuals, but also for groups, and taking that into business and taking that into organisations. Because it's partly about providing support for the people who are already working on these issues and struggle, you know, with the, in a way, it's the mental health side of it is very important, but also that mental health side gets in the way of action. You know, if you're stuck in anxiety and fear, you're not going to act. And I passionately believe that if we're to solve all the big problems that we face, not just climate change, but all these problems, it's going to demand the very best of each of us. And I think that coaching can really help bring that out, liberate the best of you, if you like, and because it's all about peeling away all the stories and all the beliefs that we hold about ourselves, which limit us. And actually, we can't afford to be limited.
And on that note, when you've been doing some coaching, what has surprised you? Actually, sort of enlighten somebody, or they maybe have enlightened you, maybe.
I think what's exciting at the moment is seeing people move into action. And we've all got this kind of untapped, to a large extent, untapped kind of you know, I suppose that emotion, whatever people are feeling around this, fear, anxiety, hopelessness, it's a very powerful energetic force. And if you can shift it from being about fear and make it about action, there is a real force there, yeah. I think.
Louise Tenacoon, thank you very much for talking
to
you today.
Thank you so much.
That was Louise Tenacoon talking to Susie Thorpe. I was really struck by what Louise said about going on demonstrations, you know, Susie, because it's exactly what I felt as well. You really want to take part in demonstrations, but you are slightly worried that you get categorised as somebody a bit kind of out there. Now, I don't think that people involved in the climate change protests are at all out there. I think they're normal people who are just terribly worried about what's going on. And that's how I feel as well, to be honest.
You're right. And she did explain, didn't she? She said that it's non-violent, it's just a civil disobedience, and it's something that we should do. We've got much more bigger things to worry about than worrying about people just sitting on pavements and stopping traffic. I know it's a big thing, but she was very honest about having worries about going on a protest, even though she's so qualified to be at a protest because she knows exactly
what it's
what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I, you're right. That's something
I was really pleased to hear her saying that in some respects, because it made me feel a bit better as well.
I thought it was interesting the way she said that there are two things that we need to think about that are on the agenda at the moment: is trying to eat the proper way, so not eating meat that will help the climate change, the movement. But she has a real struggle with flying, in the sense that she has family all over the world, especially in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite right. She said it was our birthright. We assumed it was our birthright to go on planes,
to travel.
Yeah. And now we're being told that actually it's not a good thing to do that.
I know.
So I found that quite...
It is very hard. I mean, I think everyone has a different, difficult thing to tackle when it comes to climate change. You know, if people eat a lot of meat, that's their difficult thing. For some people, it's going to be travelling. For some people, it's going to be jumping in and out of cars or using public transport. I rarely use public transport, to my shame, but mainly because I live in a place where there is no public transport, literally.
Yeah, and I can't see myself getting on a boat to any other country. I'd rather fly at the moment, I have
to say.
Well,
it would be a nice idea if you'd all the time in the world and you went on a posh cruise. But I guess the cruise liners, they're up against them as well, aren't they? They're not. Do you know what? I think if we each do something, we each do what we can and as much as we can, then it will all mount to something, won't it?
Well, as Louise said, it's all part of this jigsaw that we have to try and achieve something in it. So, yeah, well done to her.
Yeah, I thought she was great.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
You've been on my mind. I grow fonder every day, losing myself in time. Just thinking of your face, God only knows why it's taken me so long to let my doubts go. You're the only one that I want. I don't know why I'm scared. I've been here before. Every feeling, every word, I've imagined it all.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Neighbours Petra Hayton and Sophie Whedon decided to set up a business together, despite being from different generations, and they tell Linda Ness their story.
We want to be the John Lewis, don't we?
We do.
Of Pre-Loved. We sort of dream about a three-storey building with a cafe.
It has to have a cafe because we're passionate about food.
What makes neighbours consider going into business together? Not only neighbours, but women of different generations. And how do you decide what the business will be? Do you look for premises or do you use the internet? Well, we are joined today by two women who've already answered those questions, Sophie Whedon and Petra Hayton. Thank you for coming in to speak to us on Women Making Waves today, ladies.
Hello.
Hello.
So tell us your story. Your neighbours, how long have you known each other?
About 5 years.
About 5 years. Yeah. Uh-huh. But just as neighbours.
Just as neighbours.
So you were just borrowing sugar and stuff like that. And you're literally next door neighbours, aren't you?
Yeah, we're cottages attached to each other. So we're very, very close. And we enjoyed cooking together, didn't we?
Well, we both have great interest in cooking. We love interiors. Anything to do with the aesthetics, we would be in a corner whenever we met for drinks or to have supper or whatever, and we'd be just...
So you hit it off right away.
Yeah, rambling away.
Husbands are very similar, and it's just been a joy, hasn't it?
Yeah, we just got on, really. Yeah, straight away.
That's really, really good. So what made you start to think about going into business? What was the story there?
Well, I've always seen Sophie's potential. We've come from the same sort of backgrounds. I think I'm right to say that we're saleswomen from the base of our feet to the top of our head.
Absolutely.
And we've both been in the same industry, in an estate agency in the past. And I just have always wanted to work with her because I saw her potential and I never saw her fulfilled in what she was doing. It just so happened that I had an idea and it just came at the right time. Everything, it's almost like the stars aligned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And our timing was right as well in the end of it. And we came together and we just kept talking about this idea and running a business together. An idea just kept coming out and we thought, you know what, let's do it. And here we are.
So tell us about this great idea then, Petra. What was it?
The big idea is to be the John Lewis of Pre-Loved. Pre-Loved being anything that has been a part of someone else's life and they have no use for anymore.
What we used to refer to as secondhand.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We don't say that word anymore.
We don't say that anymore. That's bad, isn't it?
but secondhand always has a connotation of broken or well used or that sort of thrift.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right.
Word.
And it's
feeling
been used,
around it.
Yeah. It puts people off that it's been used, but
Pre-Loved, I mean, we have pieces of furniture or clothing or luggage that we love, but it doesn't fit our lifestyle anymore, or it doesn't fit our homes.
Or you just want something new.
Your styles change, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Women lose weight, they change jobs. And
absolutely, yes. It's exactly that. So what we're looking for is things in good condition, and we then present them in a really good way on our website. And then sell them on.
Have they got to be vintage or are you looking for a certain period? Or
we actually don't even think about vintage as such. We always say at Perth Avenue, style comes first. So it can be either, you know, beautiful label clothing pieces or it can be the best of high street. As long as it's stylish and in good condition, we'll take it, assess it and hopefully sell it for our clients.
And you mentioned the name there, Perth Avenue.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that. How did you come to Perth Avenue?
It was me.
Crazy idea from this one.
It was Petra, was it?
Yeah.
It was just in the middle of the night. I'd got up, made a cup of tea, couldn't sleep. And the name Perth Avenue came into my head. And as I always do, I wrote it down. We got a chalkboard by the kettle, wrote it down, went to sleep, didn't think anything of it. And then in the morning...
What the hell does that mean?
I just looked at it and thought, that's a really nice name for a company. It just sounds
nice. So it literally
nice.
Came in the middle of the night
it
like
did.
A dream.
It did.
But it is. It does sound quite international. It does sound quite glamorous as well, actually.
Yeah, we're trying to do that, aren't we? And The logo design was fantastic. I loved it. And when I got on board, I didn't see the need to change it. And the fact that Petra had come up with it and it was her baby, we wanted to grow it, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Yes.
So how did you start off with this? Because you'd have no stock to begin with, other than maybe stuff that you had yourselves.
Yeah, correct. It was you with a girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah, I help women clear their wardrobes. They call it a wardrobe cleanse, but actually we like to call it refit.
Yes.
I go in and help them look at what suits them now, what doesn't suit them now, give an honest opinion, encourage.
This one's the stylish one, so she's the one. I mean, she's taught me an awful lot. She's dressed me for the past 2 months, so
you're looking very glam today.
Thank you.
She is, isn't
not that
she?
Anyone
she
can see, amazing. But you can take her word for it. No, this is all Petra's doing. So I've learned an awful lot about style and fashion, whereas before I had pretty much no interest. I was spending 6 days a week in a suit, you know. So,
And when you're busy doing other things as well, Sometimes it's the last thing in your mind. You
Absolutely.
Get up in the morning, you're probably quite tired to start with. You shower and you put on something that you know will be suitable for work, but
correct, yeah,
that's it.
But you should look at your wardrobe and feel that whatever you put on is going to make you look fabulous. And I think that's everybody's right, male or female.
That's a great idea.
They're shown what to get that suits them and that they can use in maybe 10 different ways.
But how it started is Petra had a good friend of hers that she went round to her house and looked through her wardrobe, and she was moving and she said, you know, I've got to get rid of some stuff. Petra went through it. She was able to put, why don't you try this top with these jeans, or you don't need those boots anymore. And from that, we got our first stock of 100 pieces. So that's how this has grown. And from then, we've been to several wardrobe refits and clients have sent stuff to us. And we do turn things away if they don't fit our brand and we don't think they are in good enough condition.
I was going to ask you about that, actually.
No, we do. We're really strong on it. It's got to be styled and looked after. So why not give it away for someone else to
love? Something's got a hole in it, or, you know, it's just a no-no.
She's very, very good with a sewing machine and a needle. I've never seen anyone like it. But yeah, especially if it's labelled, if it is damaged, we don't think that's fair to try and sell on.
But also it's about quality. We want people to start thinking differently about secondhand or pre-loved. It doesn't have to be broken or overworn. It can just be that it doesn't work in somebody's wardrobe now, and it could work in yours.
And this is also very environmentally friendly, isn't
Correct,
it?
It's
getting things lasting longer instead of just being chucked away, potentially.
Yeah. It's a huge, huge market, and it's only going to get bigger. And we did see that, you know, why don't we start our own pre-loved company that offers something different? So the generation thing with me and Petra is that we can offer two completely different styles and eyes, and we're learning from each other every day. You know, we went in to Cambridge earlier, didn't we, and basically had a masterclass around Zara. So she's teaching me a lot, and she's made me feel very confident about myself, you know. So she's now taught me that don't look at a size. So I will buy a size up and not think about it, because it actually is more flattering and makes you look better.
Yeah, that is a good idea, isn't it?
It is. So as a stylist, she's very good at that.
I know there are lots of shops that have one size. Well, how come that works? It does work quite well, actually.
Yeah, because we're not all one size. But
no, we're not. We actually have a piece of clothing that we've called the Perth dress.
Yeah, we have a share wardrobe. So we think about putting a hatch in between our walls.
We do have a share wardrobe. It's really good fun.
It is a way of being able to
But it just shows people how different body shapes can wear the same things, but it just looks slightly different, or you wear it slightly differently.
Yeah. Where'd you keep all these clothes then?
Well, luckily I have a spare room.
Yes, she does.
And I'm hugely organised. That's my big thing, is I'm a planner and I'm organised. And every client has their own box, and everything's closed and sealed from the light and also from critters. I know there's no critters in my house.
No, but the moths go everywhere.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So anything that I'm particularly concerned about, I will put in the freezer, actually. Because
Really?
if you put anything that you're concerned about or has been in a home that might have moths, in a bag, pop them in your freezer, and that will normally sort them out.
Well, that's a top tip. That's really good. You also do pop-up shops, don't you? Tell us about that.
Oh, they're so fun. We have lots of items. We sort of try and cater for maybe ages 16 to 60, sizes God, down to size 6 to size 22. So we like to think that we can offer something to anyone, whether you're looking for a designer handbag or a lovely pair of shoes or a coat. And the pop-up shops we've done recently, we actually carried out one for dementia, didn't we, which was quite fun.
Alzheimer's and dementia.
So you were actually raising funds for them?
You contributed, didn't you, to any earnings, which was good. So we basically set up a shop with our rails and our mannequin that we call Betsy. She's so fun.
Betsy is our mascot. She's very dear to us.
We touch her up a lot, yeah. She wears size 8 very tightly.
We do like the fact she's a size 10.
Oh, yeah, she's a 10.
You'll have to set her up on your website as a character,
she's
really, won't you?
Yeah, she's the main image in the Jaeger blue jacket, so people know her from there.
Well, you can always have an Ask Betsy.
Top tips.
The freezer.
Thank you very much. That's going down in the book.
Yeah, I wish she could talk sometimes, actually. But no, we take her, we set up a shop, we take a selection of items, and yeah, Petra and I stand there and have this pop-up shop, which is so fun. So we sell for our clients, and any profits made are split with the client. So,
what's really interesting is that Sophie has never worked in any sort of retail environment, fashion environment. And on our first pop-up, she did all the merchandising, and I was blown away by how she put things together and how she created a mood within our little mini store. And so easily, it just shows me, and I've always known she has a sense of style, but her confidence has never been there. It's never been...
Well, if you've never done it before, it's hard as well.
Yeah.
So you're a natural, are you?
She is a natural.
What can I say? No, I've learned an awful lot from Petra, and believe me, I do take everything in, and hopefully that's why it's going to contribute to a really successful avenue of what we're trying to go down.
Yeah, but your photography is... something else.
I do like our photography, yeah. So I take lots of pictures of Betsy, and we're lucky enough to have a lovely big open space in Petra's house.
And a great technician who comes in and helps us with with our camera support.
Yeah,
and...
Petra's husband. Big shout out to Ted.
IT department.
Yes. If we feed him toast and cake regularly, he is fully operational.
So it's a real family kind of business. I was going to ask what your family's felt about you doing this for a living. They're very supportive, presumably.
Well, really, my mum and parents are really proud. My dad and everyone around me, they also asked me, you know, is Petra going to be able to deal with you on a daily basis? But it's going pretty well. She's a fantastic cook, so I get great lunches. But no, they're very proud, and well, I'd like to think they are anyway, but we just work very, very well together, and the concept that we have, hopefully offering someone something different, is gonna work.
Have you ever fallen out about anything?
No.
You've never disagreed?
No, we're pretty straight-talking women. Yeah.
And you'll compromise, one will compromise.
Well, I've got a situation that I thought you might quite like, in that when we're looking over clients' clothing, the kitchen table is quite large, it's about 6 foot, isn't it? So that's cleared, and then the consignment goes on the top. Mm-hmm. And from there, we have three chairs.
Yep.
There's a no and a yes. And the maybe is often an interesting discussion.
That's where the compromise comes in.
And this is where the straight talking comes in too.
Yeah.
Because there'll be a passionate Sophie saying, but I love this. And I'll be saying, but it's not right. And it's not right because of this. Why isn't it because of this? But
we are selling that shirt.
So what we had to do was create
a maybe stool. Yeah.
And what happens is we have the maybe stool, and then we go away and leave that maybe stool till the next day. And then the next day...
I come running through with my tail between my legs going, yeah, you're right, that's not going to work.
I must say, 9 times out of 10, I win.
And I'm quite stubborn, so that's her. So, yeah, you can imagine those move on very swiftly.
But that's nice. It sounds like you work really, really well together. And that's what you need in business, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because this split between being friends... And people say you should never mix friendship with business. Mm. I'm assuming that you haven't found any problems from what you're saying.
No, not at all. And I think we're not in the same social circles. we're great neighbours and we love each other as friends, as the two couples, I think because we have separate lives outside of that, that helps us work. But we both have talents in different areas, and what they've done is interlocked. We've just been lucky that
it does sound like your talents are tailor-made
balanced.
For running this business with the photography, and,
yes.
and you've got this eye for merchandise, and you've got a very good eye for fashion and all. Yeah. It does sound like you're kind of dovetailing together very well.
Yeah, absolutely.
What plans have you got? Have you got a business plan?
We want to be the John Lewis, don't we?
We do.
Of Pre-Loved. So we sort of dream about a three-story building with a cafe.
It has to have a cafe because we're passionate about food.
Oh, I've started to bake as well, which is really impressive apparently. So I should have brought some in for you, sorry.
You should have, yes.
So rude.
I'll encourage anyone to bake.
Yes.
Always.
So you actually want the bricks and mortar eventually?
At some point, yes, but it's got to be different from what's on the high street already. You see, I see a store of some sort these days as an agency or an avenue for other brands to come in. So in my head, I can see the cafe being all the seating and everything maybe coming from IKEA,
mm-hmm.
so that people can sit in it and feel it and
use it, yes.
and then go and buy it online.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see the way of retail changing. There'll be collaborations with brands coming into smaller new startups, taking advantage of the agileness of it.
We're keen to help out other women that, you know, may be looking for somebody that makes, you know, really interesting jewellery or placemats or something for the house. Or
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, brand-wise, probably startups would be the dream, wouldn't it, to help
women? Absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely.
So not just big designer.
No, not at all.
Names.
Absolutely not, really. I'd like to be more artisan-led. People like us, in the same position as us, that maybe aren't confident about using computers, maybe not confident about putting themselves out front in the store, so to speak, and letting us help them do that. We want to be a platform.
Mm-hmm.
So, but with both our ages, we can talk to both groups. And there's many women of my age that are incredibly creative and don't feel confident about using computers, that don't have somebody like their IT department, Ted, who's able to help them. We just need to get out and do it.
You know, it's strange because I started off at the beginning wondering if there were problems and conflicts with the generational difference, and I've changed my mind completely, and now I'm seeing that there must be huge benefits to this actually.
Yeah, no, that's really nice to hear, because that's exactly how we feel, and we're just very real women that have had sales careers and just wanted to be our own boss and have our own rules, and we know that we can really make something special, so that's what we're going for. But yeah, pop-ups, we've got one happening, two in December. All the dates will be on our social media, and we put a really exciting little Facebook ad out yesterday that's gone down really well. Help from Ted again. But yes, it's an exciting time, and we're just pushing to get out as much as possible. We're seeing a lot of clients, which is great, and getting some really good stock. So yeah, check out our website.
Petra and Sophie, thank you very much for coming in and talking to Women Making Waves today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure for us too. We've
yes.
had a lot of fun. Thank you.
And that was Sophie Whedon and Petra Hayton talking to Linda Ness. The pre-love business is very interesting because they're absolutely right. We do care about nice things that we've bought that we think is a little bit expensive, but we want them. But at what stage do I want to give up my good stuff? And I suppose in many ways, I suppose if we're knowing it goes to another person, that we know that they're going to enjoy
it. Yeah, maybe feels a little bit better.
Yeah.
Because I think we've all got clothes like that.
Mm.
You know, the posh clothes that you maybe only wear a few times.
Exactly.
And then you think, my goodness, I paid X amount of eye-watering, you know, pounds for this. And I've only worn it to maybe a wedding or another occasion. Yes, it's still kind of. I don't tend to do that anymore, I have to say. Mm. But I used to do that kind of thing quite a lot.
And I'm actually quite jealous because they are neighbours. Mm-hmm. And it's very rare to find neighbours and become good friends in many
That's
ways,
true.
Isn't it? I mean, you find them at work mm-hmm. and you find them when you go on activities. But when you're living.
Well, often the very opposite, in fact. You know,
yeah.
you hear so many stories about neighbours not
well, exactly,
getting on.
Exactly, yeah.
But these two, oh, they get on like a house on fire.
They do, you know? Don't they?
Like mother and daughter, really.
Well, that's right. Absolutely. Mm. And so I love that. I thought it was very, very endearing. And I really, really hope they do really well. And the other thing I liked about it, and you were mentioning in the interview, you talked about size. Why do you just pick something that actually fits you and not worry
yeah.
about the size?
Yeah. I think
really
that's...
good lesson there, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. No, it's true. I think we are. And I think it is very depressing if... You, I remember years and years ago in Marks and Spencer's, and I had a size 12, and I pulled on jeans. They didn't come anywhere. And I thought, oh no, and I had to go to a size 14. And that has just it's been declining ever since. But it is that moment where you think, oh no. And actually, it you know, could have been just a small, it wasn't, I think. I think it was right. I think it was a size 14 I needed. But, you know, it could just be small made, they say, a bit like being big boned. Small made.
Exactly. Small made or different designers and different companies making different sizes. But
that's right.
I thought it was really good because it takes the stress out of thinking that you have to be a certain size mm-hmm. to really look good in a particular clothes. And I love that. They were really refreshing and it sounds like they get on really well.
Oh, they do. And I think, you know, we were talking about environmental stuff earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is actually kind of in line with that because it means that we're not putting things in the bin. Well, although I guess maybe charity shops would be the next stop for a lot of these clothes. But maybe you feel that, you know, you're going to make a few bob out of them as well, potentially.
Yeah. And I've learned a lesson actually because there are a few of my clothes that have been mothballed or have been eaten. And she says she puts them, is it?
In the freezer.
Puts them in the freezer. What
yeah.
a good idea.
It is a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If
you've got lots of freezer space.
Well, I was going to say.
there's never been any room in my freezer.
Well, there's some frozen peas about six times worth.
Imagine the disappointment of your husband's face when he pulls out a blouse
yes.
instead of that pizza you
oh,
expecting.
Oh, yeah, but I know what will happen with my husband. He'll look at that piece of clothing that's frozen and think, well, that's great. I can wrap that round my limb.
I think they'll make a go of it because they are really, really enthusiastic, passionate and energetic. So I think they'll do really well.
They will. And it's fantastic to see great neighbours being good friends.
Yes. Love thy neighbour. And that's all we've time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Louise Tennekoon, Petra Hayton and Sophie Whedon.
If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her. You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also catch up on our programmes on cambridge105.co.uk and can visit our website womenmakingwaves.co.uk where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.